The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow today.
Aloha! Yes, it's me, Braden Avas. My friends and I are taught cooperation in school. Can you grown-ups please cooperate? We need to work together for our environment. Mahalo. Take it, solar guy!
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal on this Tuesday, May 20th, and I am so excited for today's show, The Wonders of Marine Science. As Jacques Cousteau once said, the future is in the hands of those who explore. And today we have some of Hawaii's leading researchers who will be talking about amazing science and unique projects exploring our ocean planet. First up is Dr. Ruth Gates, a researcher at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, University of Hawaii, who is focused on coral reefs and climate change stressors. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Carly.
Now, Ruth, you've been on our show before, so you're just so awesome. We had to have you back again. And you do such interesting work. First, let us know, what is the most wondrous part of your research, or what kind of captures your attention most?
Well, I work on animals that form entire ecosystems. So they have so many attributes in their biology that make them fascinating. They lay down huge amounts of bone-like structure that creates the incredible complexity of coral reefs. And they're beautiful to look at. They have loads of other animals that live inside their tissues and in within their branches, within their skeletons. They're fascinating. So I get to do what I love to do, which is to spend time working on why and how they function, why they respond to climate change in the way that they do, and also working with many young people, young scientists, who are equally fascinated by the wonders of coral reefs.
Do you have a particular species that you like working with, or is it kind of all corals?
All corals. I am a generalist when it comes to corals. They're fabulous.
That's good. You're not seeking anybody out in particular there.
No.
So you talk a little bit about they support life for other animals and they're really unique. What is so special about these organisms? What makes them so important to us?
Well, you know, in terms of humans, they are really the trees of the forest. They create enormously diverse ecosystems. So here in Hawaii, they are found immediately adjacent to the land. And because they form solid structure, they serve to protect the land behind them from the energy of major storms coming in from the Pacific. So they're very important in terms of coastal security. They're also really important in food security. So they are home to many of the fish species that we eat. And so corals themselves are the house for the fish. So they basically are incubators for baby fish that we like to eat as adults. And, of course, here in Hawaii, you can't really talk about reefs and not talk about tourism. So from an economic perspective, you know, many people come to Hawaii to spend time on the reefs.
And what is your biggest concern regarding our coral reefs here in Hawaii?
So I think that there are two sets of concerns that I have. There's this sort of global concerns that are associated with climate change. And we've heard a lot in the news about the warming of the oceans and the gradual acidification of the oceans. These are two things that are occurring as these massive atmospheric CO2 loads are dissolving into our waters. These shifts are really very detrimental to the way in which corals function. They are growing more slowly. They are not able to actually lay down their skeletons to create their structures. And so that's one category of stressors that we're very concerned of. But here in Hawaii, there's a lot of people living very close to reefs, and our activities on land have huge implications. So there are local pollutants and local stresses associated with, say, our massive rainstorms, when we have land that's being cleared, often the topsoil washes straight into the nearshore ocean. Corals don't do well when there's a lot of sediments or cloudy water above them. They don't respond well to pollutants, things like the nutrients that we put on golf courses to keep them green, those very same things, really, corals don't respond well. And then there's, of course, things like cars. Rainwater washing off the roads is washing a huge amount of petroleum products into the water. That's not good. So there are as many things that we do as a population on land that has very negative implications. So to sum it up, we have global stressors that really are a global problem, and then we have local stressors. And I would advocate that we can do something about a lot of the local problems that we have here in Hawaii to actually sustain reefs on the long term.
So going back to those global stressors, just yes. So we can make that link there, So you mentioned CO2, so carbon dioxide. How do we go from carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to warming and acidification in the ocean?
It's a really good question. And essentially, if you can think of the Earth as a balloon, and inside the balloon, there's our land mass and our ocean, that round ball. And we're pumping up that balloon with a lot of carbon dioxide, and that carbon dioxide has to go somewhere. It can't escape the balloon, so it's pressed, essentially, compressed into the water column. And that change in the overall amount of carbon dioxide in the water has huge implications for global weather. It has changed the way in which ocean currents are running. We've got a lot of melting of the ice caps, and we have this declining pH in the water. The chemistry is changing. That reflects this dissolved CO2 into the water. Collectively, it is a progressive problem. That is, we are increasing the temperature on the planet globally. We know that. We're seeing very extreme temperatures on land and in the ocean. And we're seeing changes in our atmospheric chemistry. A lot more pollutants, a lot of changes. We don't often talk about the atmospheric CO2, but it's that atmospheric CO2 that's causing the acidification in the water.
So we have these local problems and we have these global problems. How does your research look at these effects on coral reefs?
So one of the things that's very interesting, Carly, about corals and reefs in particular is that there are many different species of corals. And when we watch corals and we see how they respond to a particular stress, be it warming or acidification or pollution, what we know is that some corals will show signs of being horribly impacted and others will be doing fine. And my research is really focused on distinguishing features in the coral biology that underlies the ability of some corals to withstand stress and others to not.
That's really interesting. And, you know, that you can relate that to so many things. I mean,
absolutely.
Even like diseases in people, some people respond differently. And so that makes sense that we would see that.
Absolutely. I mean, if we think about something like cancer, we know that some people have a genetic predisposition to suffer from cancer and that there are others that don't have that gene. And so they are not going to be susceptible to that same disease. We also know that there are some environments that will promote in disease in some people, but not in others. And we don't really understand the complexities of that, but we know it is some combination of genetics and experience.
So do you find that the physiology of corals is also affected? Like some of the hardier, thicker corals might do better than branching corals?
Or? Absolutely. There are two really major categories. Actually, there's three. Of shapes of corals on the reef. One looks like a big boulder. It's actually very dull. It's very important because it's very, very sturdy from a skeleton perspective. And the others are the ones that we tend to sort of see a lot in pictures, the ones that have these huge branches and you see lots of fish, big plates with fish hiding underneath. So they create a lot of space for other organisms. What we find is that the more architecturally complex, the ones that are home to many other organisms, tend to be the more sensitive to stress. And the boulders are much more resistant to disturbance, which is interesting. And we do think that there are various attributes in the biology that actually reflect why those two are differently affected. But it's important to note that just like humans, there are individuals within each of those categories that are more or less susceptible to disturbance.
And are you finding any trends with our Hawaii's corals and the research that you've done thus far?
Absolutely. I think one of the most surprising things we find is that corals, that the environment around reefs in Hawaii is actually not the same around our islands. So there are particular areas around the island where the temperatures may fluctuate quite widely, and others where the temperatures are relatively flat. They don't fluctuate very much at all. What we're finding is corals that are in the fluctuating environments actually doing a lot better than corals that are preconditioned in these relatively benign settings, which is actually a feature that we are starting to see emerge from all over the world. We have corals flourishing in locations that we would predict they would all be dead in. And the feature that seems to be important is the rate at which the temperature or the pH, the chemistry of the water, changes. If it happens on a daily basis, it goes up and down very rapidly, it seems to actually be a really good thing. And we think that's quite hopeful. Essentially, I sort of describe it like exercising a human being. You put a human on a treadmill and you make them run. Over time, they become much more able to run, and eventually they can run a marathon. And that's what we think is happening with corals, that when they start to see these fluctuations, that they are better able to actually withstand them in the future. And so we use those types of experiments, actually, to see if we can increase their resistance.
That's fascinating. And this research that you're doing is not only applied to the University of Hawaii in your research at Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, but you are now getting some attention otherwise for this research. And you have recently won a prestigious award, the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation Award. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it was an interesting, the award we won was a challenge, actually. The Paul Allen Foundation basically challenged the marine science world to come up with ideas for mitigating the impacts of ocean acidification. And myself and my colleague from the Australian Institute of Marine Biology, Dr. Madeline Van Oppen, submitted an idea to assist corals to become more resistant to future conditions. And we based our idea on essentially 25 years of basic research that suggested that corals perhaps could adapt more rapidly than we would normally assume, and that we could potentially harness that capacity to breed corals that could resist future conditions.
So all this research that you're doing, you're going to be doing some marathon training for corals, essentially, in the face of climate change.
That's exactly right. We sort of have a three-pronged approach, Carly. Mm-hmm. So what we're first, like you would do with humans if you were choosing an athlete, for example, and trying to train an athlete, you would look for those most gifted members in the population. So we'd go out there and we'd scout for the corals that are doing the best. We then take those corals and we train them. And we train them by basically exposing them to the conditions of the future in very gradual increments. So playing with their environmental conditions. And the hope is then that they will switch on their capacity to actually extend their functional range. And what we then like to do is to make sure that they're well fed. And what's so fascinating about corals is they have these plant-like individuals living inside their tissues that essentially feed them. And what we know is if we slightly change who they partner with, we can actually increase their resistance. So just like we know for humans, our gut is actually able to host many microbes. And we now know that those microbes are actually controlling things like our sleep cycles and the type of food that we are able to digest. So it's very exciting. So essentially what we would do, we're doing what we would do if we were trying to train an athlete.
That's fantastic. And have you started your scouting process? Do you have any candidates yet?
We have started our scouting. And, you know, we're not only interested in really understanding what happens in this particular generation. So what we're doing right now is to identify individuals within species that are the most resistant to disturbance. And we do that by exposing them to disturbance and looking for the ones that perform best. But what we're then doing is we're crossbreeding those that perform best. So if you take two super athletes and they have a child, often the offspring will be exceptionally gifted from an athletic perspective. And so we are using that same approach then to not only improve the resistance of corals in one generation, but hopefully translate that improvement through multiple generations.
And is this type of work taking place in, open ocean or in a lab setting? How are you doing this
recruitment? That's a great question. We are doing a combination of lab and open ocean. So a lot of what's so unique about working at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology is the coral reefs are immediately adjacent to us. That means we can be on the reef 365 days a year, and we can work with corals in captivity that are fed by live ocean water that is identical to what comes off the reef. And so we can take that water and we can just change the temperature, but everything else stays exactly the same. So in some ways, when you do an experiment like this, often you do it in a hatchery that's completely independent from the natural setting. What's unique about us is we don't want to breed or work with boutique corals that have been basically tuned to a very narrow type of experience in a laboratory. We want to breed corals that are ready to go out onto the reef. And so we're doing pilot experiments in these water-fed raceways on Coconut Island with the hope that we will then be able to grow these corals out on the reef. But our first order of business is to identify the super athletes and to begin to train them.
What exciting work. I mean, just being on the cutting edge of this research, it's fantastic. I have to ask the last question for you. What is the most hopeful and depressing part of your work? I mean, you're using this exciting new technology and method, but at the same time, it is not, climate change is not a happy topic.
It is not a happy topic. And perhaps the most depressing part is that we're having to do this work at all. And I am a total optimist, but I'm also a realist. I understand that we've pushed our reefs far. They have declined in integrity dramatically globally. And here in Hawaii, we are not immune from those problems. And so my perspective is that we can do something about it. Now is the time. But if we wait too long, we will probably not have much biological material to work with. I think one other thing that is a little bit depressing is in some cases the work is misrepresented or confused with the GMO debate. And people are saying you're basically designing corals and you're doing design or GMO corals. And that is not true. What we are doing is essentially what we do with our athletes every day. And we never question that. We think that's absolutely fine. We are essentially doing a natural acceleration, and we are not introducing any foreign DNA into the system. And that is, of course, what happens with GMOs. So it's depressing to me that a positive project can be misconstrued and in some cases misrepresented as something that's not so positive. Our goal is to conserve our reefs, and I am passionate about moving this research forward such that we have the biological capacity to do that.
Well, I cannot wait to see the results. Dr. Gates, you are always an inspiration. Thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you,
I can't
Callie.
Wait to hear more. We're going to take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, we will be doing some more exploring with Dr. Glazer. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors, Leakmaster Roofing, Kamayama Solar, Jeff Davis. Contact him if you're interested in solar, Grand Solar, BenQ Solar.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Several new accidents were reported downtown on the Poly at Vineyard Boulevard, on North King at A'ala Park, and we got one on Nimitz by Hilo Hatties. The Trip West has both freeways backed up to Middle Street. Inbound from the west, slow from Middle Street to the Punahou exit. Remember, there's going to be a full closure again of the H1 freeway eastbound tonight from the Vineyard exit in Kalihi to the Vineyard on-ramp downtown, 8 p.m. till 5 a.m.
You want to get solar for all the right reasons, to live greener and get your utility bills under control. But the one thing you don't want is to get stuck with a solar conversion system that can't keep up with changing electrical rules and regulations. So get a system that's future perfect, one smart enough to let you use all the renewable energy you can produce, plus store the surplus for when you want to use it. That's Outback Power, with exclusive grid hybrid technology backed by legendary support. With an Outback power system, you can have it all. Net metering when it's available or off-grid independence when it makes the most sense. Contact Outback Power Technologies for an installation specialist near you. If you're unhappy with the high prices or the way you've been treated by mainland corporations, get rid of them. Let Hank's Tax Service help you. Hank and his employees have been preparing taxes in Hawaii for close to 20 years. The sharpest preparers from Hank's 2 decades of unparalleled tax service have rejoined him to serve you, not make money for a mainland corporation. If you're paying over $200, you're paying way too much. Get rid of that mainland corporation and come to Hank's. Hank's Tax Service, 853-1170. 853-1170.
Aloha, this is your solar guy, Jeff Davis here. If you have any questions regarding HECO's new regulations for photovoltaics or solar electric in your neighborhood, as you know, they have new rules, just call me at 554-7200. I'll answer your questions most likely right over the phone, 554-7200. And please don't forget, solar hot water, solar-powered pool pumps, solar heating, all that is good to go. I can handle any of those questions as well. Call your solar guy at 554-7200. Aloha.
Hi, I'm Frank Rogers from Leakmaster Roofing and the Cool Roof Store. We sell and install protective roof coatings for all types of roofs. What kind of roof do you have? For flat roofs, we recommend silicone roof coatings because they withstand unlimited ponding water and they come with a 50-year material warranty. We feature trusted names like Geico, NXT Cool Zone, and Apoc Silicone with some of the lowest prices in town. If you have a Monier roof or a metal roof, we recommend that you recoat them with NXT Cool Zone to make them shine like new. Asphalt shingles can be protected and waterproof for the lifetime of your home with the Cool Roof Store's ceramic coating. Whether you want Leakmaster Roofing to install the coating or want to do it yourself, come on down to our store in Kaka'ako or visit us at leakmaster.com. Why re-roof when you can simply recoat?
Aloha. Hawaii's Tomorrow and Jeff Davis are looking for motivated people. Are you a writer? The Solar Guy could use some comedy. Would you like to intern? You know he's got room, so give Jeff a call. Jeff Davis at 554-7200. 554-7200.
Aloha nohoi kako and ho mai kai nohoi praise to Jeff Davis.
You're terrible at this.
I'm terrible, am I?
I love you, Ruby. Aloha. Hi, it's Jeff. Aloha. It seems as though Hawaiian Electric has made their decision to slow down photovoltaic solar electric installation throughout this last tax season. Many people have turned to battery storage systems to save money on the upgrades and to beat the tax season. These battery storage systems are standalone. You're not connected to the grid. You do receive this year's tax credits for them, and you can install them in any area on the island at any time. It's a fantastic idea. Now, I'm Kamiyama Solar, and we've installed many of these systems in the past. If you have any questions for me, they can be answered generically with a phone call. So go ahead and get to me, Jeff Davis, your solar guy, regarding battery storage systems for your photovoltaics this year at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. Aloha!
Aloha! It's me, Braden DeVos. And again, I ask a favor. Will you help restock the fish on our reefs so when my friends and I go snorkeling, we can see Hawaii as it should be? Mahalo. Thank you, Solar Guy.
Welcome back to the show. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. Today we have Dr. Brian Glazer, an associate professor in the Department of Oceanography at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, I have to say, when I walked into your office a few weeks ago, I have never met anyone so passionate about what they do. Can you tell us a little bit about what you study? Kind of give me the spiel you gave me when I walked into your office.
Sure. I get to study the ocean and live in Hawaii. What could be better than that? I mean, it really is that fundamentally rooted in me. You mentioned Jacques Cousteau at the beginning of the show. When I was four years old, I told my parents I wanted to be a marine biologist. I had no idea what it was. I had no idea what it meant, but I knew I wanted to do something with the oceans, and I ended up being able to get to play that out. I, of course, am now not a marine biologist, but I do get to study some fundamental interactions in the oceans. What my lab does has kind of a fingerprint from my training in blending aspects of biology, microbiology, and chemistry in a marine setting in the oceans, and especially at places where you have a transition between oxygen and areas of no oxygen. And the neat thing about marine settings is that on almost anywhere on the planet, when you go into a marine setting on some scale, whether it's a through time in a temporal setting or on a vertical scale through looking from the water column into the sediments, you can find this transition where you have an absence of oxygen. And we humans, animals, are very boring because if you take away our oxygen, we die. We're completely displaced. And microbes are not. They're very innovative. They're very diverse and able to use all kinds of other different chemistry. And in a little nutshell, that's what my lab does in a variety of different aspects here in coastal sands in Hawaii and also in the deep ocean, looking at deep volcanoes on the seafloor as well.
There's something so mysterious about that when you say, you know, deep ocean volcanoes. You study such ecosystems that are rare and very few people get to see these areas. What's it like to explore these unknown crevices?
It's very cool. It's never boring. More people have been launched into space than have visited the deep ocean. That's something you'll hear time and time again when you hear about the deep submergence vehicle Alvin, which was most famous maybe for exploring the Titanic. I've gotten to cruise with Alvin at different hydrothermal events in the Pacific, in the Gulf of California. And in recent years, my own interests have shifted a little bit more to not actually visiting the seafloor myself in a submersible, but using underwater robots, remote operated vehicles, ROVs, the ROV Jason, which actually found the Titanic before Alvin visited it. Even just chemical oceanography, CTD cruises that we go out. We call them cruises. And of course, my family members laugh and picture shuffleboard and, you know, mimosas in the morning. And of course, it's nothing like that at all from an oceanographic research cruise perspective. But even cruises where you're not visiting the seafloor, going out and collecting water through the water column, it's very exciting to do that.
So let's take a step back here. I want to explore this more. Tell us, for those of us that don't know, what are hydrothermal vents?
Yeah, it's a great question. Anybody who's been to Volcanoes National Park on the Big Island, if you can picture the lava fields out there and picture some of those sulfur fumarole vents where you have interactions of the land and water percolating down into the rock with the atmosphere, not even necessarily lava, just the venting steam that comes out of that. And think about all the different chemical reactions that occur between the water as it interacts with the rock, as it becomes heated, and then vents back up to the surface. Here in Hawaii, it's very easy for a lot of people to picture that. And if you've never seen some of the images that come on Discovery Channel or Nat Geo TV of giant 6-foot-long tube worms, those kinds of organisms live on a 70,000-kilometer-long mountain chain. It's a 70,000-kilometer-long volcano, if you will, that circles our planet. And at that mountain chain, there's an interaction between the heat from the interior of the planet and the deep, cold ocean water. As that cold ocean water percolates down through the fractured rock, which looks a lot like Volcanoes National Park, it's just maybe 2,500 meters deep under the sea surface, it becomes superheated and then vents back up. And as it cools again after venting, it precipitates out all these different heavy, usually heavy metal-rich mineral precipitates, which form these giant chimneys and smoker, white smokers and black smokers that you sometimes do see on Nat Geo TV or Discovery Channel. And the magic about this system is that in those places, life without light is driven by the microbial biosphere, if you will. And so a lot of people that you talk to on the street or bus or at Thanksgiving dinner with my family, they think, oh, microbes, bacteria, you know, that's something we want to kill. Get out the Purell and, you know, eliminate this. And of course, from our perspective as environmental scientists, that's not at all the case. And especially in the deep ocean, it's primarily a microbial environment.
And this microbial environment is unique to this area, and you see all kinds of different organisms there. Can you describe some of them?
Yeah, definitely. If we back up just for a second, you know, we've explored less than 10%, 5 to 10% of the entire global deep ocean. Our planet's 70% ocean, and the average water depth is over 2 miles. And it's kind of analogous to flying from here to Washington, D.C., and in a jet airliner, and somewhere over Kansas, dropping a bucket, scooping up some dirt in a cornfield in Kansas, and looking at it and saying, this is what North America looks like. And only recently, in the last 10 to 20 to 30 years, have we been able to have the technology to visit these places and look at them and learn something about the life that's there. And so these on-ridge axes, this 70,000-kilometer-long volcano has been well-known since the mid to late 70s or so. And as we explore a little bit more, we start to understand the differences between those systems and something like where we live on, a hotspot island chain of Hawaii. And the particular project that we're going to get into a little more detail about and that I'm studying now is looking at the newest Hawaiian island volcano that's popping up just off the shore of the Big Island, Lauihi Seamount. And it's very interesting because the chemistry and the geology of the rock that fuels the growth of Lauihi is distinct from those on-axis ridge systems, which we do know a lot more about.
And so this seamount, Lo'ihi, what kind of, describe the environment. What would you see when you go down there?
Yeah, it's very cool. It's this big, leaky iron mountain in the middle of the ocean in the Pacific. And the summit of the mountain is about 1,000 meters below the sea surface. And it honestly does look very much like Volcanoes National Park, except that it's rust covered. And so instead of seeing black rock everywhere, you get to see rust. And, you know, sometimes we can go into the basement of the building and scrape some rust off of a rusty pipe and look at the water, rust, iron, and microbe interactions that might be happening in the basement. And sometimes we make sacrifices and go out and use ships and submersibles and do this in a really cool environment like Lo'ihi. And it is this underwater volcano that's over 3,000 feet below the sea surface at the summit and drops down all the way to the bottom of the ocean at 5,000 meters, close to 15,000 feet deep. And the nature of Lo'ihi and the nature of the Hawaiian Islands is such that the seawater that interacts with the rock as it grows into a volcano is distinct from what we see at the mid-ocean ridges. And it's very well tailored toward these iron oxidizing microbes, these bacteria that make a living out of pulling the iron from the rock and from the hydrothermal fluids, turning that into rust and gaining energy from that and providing kind of the base of the food chain there.
And exploring these unique areas, you touched on the importance of the technology and the ability to do that. Now, you're going out to Lo'ihi very soon with the Falkor, which is Schmidt Ocean Institute's boat. Can you tell us a little bit about that expedition?
Sure. We were originally slated for 31 days on the research vessel Falkor, which is somewhat of a new endeavor from the Schmidt Ocean Institute. A number of years ago, Eric and Wendy Schmidt decided that they wanted to enable oceanographic research from more than the standpoint of just a hobby and provide ship-based researchers the opportunity to go out and explore the deep ocean. And the Schmidt Ocean Institute provides this very nice balance between hypothesis-driven science that is really directed, where you almost know what you're going to find and you just need the capability to get there and do the experiments, and exploration-based science. And that's what we're going to be doing a lot of at Lo'ihi. Over the last 6 or 7 years, we've had a variety of different federally funded expeditions to Lo'ihi. And so we know a few spots where we're going to go, where we're going to explore, and where we're going to revisit. And we also will spend about half the cruise exploring some new areas, which, frankly, the federal resources aren't available for that kind of exploration-based resource. So, one, there's that. The Schmidt Ocean Institute has a little bit of a higher risk tolerance for some exploration, which is very badly needed. Two is that just visiting the seafloor, we see something new on every dive. Now, what you may, or some of your listeners may have heard, is that our expedition was originally slated to use a hybrid ROV, one of these robots that can go down in the deepest diving. It was just out on an expedition a couple weeks ago to 11,000 meters in the Kermadec Trench. And the vehicle was lost. This is an $8 million robot that imploded at about 10,000 meters and is out there lost on the seafloor. And so in the last 2 weeks, through the amazing work with the folks at Schmidt Ocean Institute, we're able to salvage what was slated for our cruise to be about a month long exploring Lo'ihi with this remote operated vehicle, get a replacement vehicle that is more capable in some aspects and not as capable in other aspects, and salvage most of the science that we wanted to do. And so we'll be going out from the end of June through the beginning of July coming up on the Falkor.
Well, I'm excited to see what you're able to explore and produce from this expedition. When we had chatted a couple weeks ago, you mentioned that you're not just going to visit the summit. You're going to be able to look around and be able to map some of these areas. How would you go about doing that?
Exactly. That's a wonderful question. And so the overall expedition research plan has aspects of geology, because the environment, the hydrothermal environment at Lo'ihi is unique because of the Hawaiian Islands' unique geology. It has aspects of kind of chemical oceanography, biogeochemistry. How does Lo'ihi interact with the Pacific Ocean at large? What is the fate, and what are some of the chemical transformations of all that iron that's being pumped out of the volcano into the midwater in the water column? And then aspects of very fundamental questions about how are these microbes living on the chemistry of the fluid that comes out. And so with the loss of an ROV, we're not as well positioned to answer some of those very fundamental micro-mineral reactions that occur on the seafloor, which we would need real-time communication with a vehicle on the bottom. We would need a manipulator arm to actually retrieve some of the instruments and incubation experiments that we deployed last year. We won't be able to do that, but we'll be able to salvage the other two-thirds of our research objectives. We will use an AUV. This is an unmanned kind of a robot vehicle that goes over, programmed by itself, and can do a mow-the-lawn kind of a pattern with very high-resolution mapping capabilities. It has chemical sensors on it, so it will sniff in the water column and tell us if we're finding any new kind of hydrothermal vents at the very bottom of the volcano at 5,000 meters, which maybe is where new eruptions are happening, where Luigi's summit got its start, if you will.
Excellent. And I want to go back to the loss of Nereus for a second here, because I think it's really important to understand the challenges of deep sea research and, the needed exploration aspect of it, but also why it's so hard and why it takes so much money and time to be able to do this.
Yeah, that's great. The folks who do this, we don't take it for granted, but we almost do. And to send a vehicle down to 10,000 or 11,000 meters where Nereus was one of the only vehicles capable of working is hard. And the engineers who build these things will tell you that, landing on the moon, there's a reason we did it in the 60s and we're only doing this kind of work now. This is much, much harder. It's harder to work at 16,000 PSI than it is in a vacuum. And so there are some analogies and some parallelisms in the kind of engineering that goes on between folks at NASA, at JPL, and folks at Woods Hole or other folks that are engineering these kinds of remotely operated vehicles. It's all hard. It's all very tough. And to do it under this excruciating pressures makes anything very tough to try to put electronics in housings and do that. What happened with Nereus is that in order to work at 10 and 11,000 meters, most of the engineering that allows shallower vehicles, say 2,000 or 5,000 meters, none of that works. It's a whole new ballgame when you get down below 6,000 meters. And that's why so little of that environment has been explored. And so the experimental capabilities that allowed Nereus to dive there, the capabilities that went into Jim Cameron's vehicle to allow him to visit 11,000 meters are very expensive, and they're very experimental and are sometimes prone to failures. And that's probably what happened with Nereus, is that you had a single housing or a single flotation sphere that failed under that immense pressure. And once that happens, it sets off an entire chain reaction, like a quarter stick of dynamite, and then 20 of them going off. And so one thing is that it's very hard to do it. Two is there's very small margin for error. Anything goes wrong and it becomes pretty disastrous pretty fast. And then thirdly, because it is so hard to do, there's very few vehicles capable of doing it. The Japanese have a vehicle that is less capable than Nereus was, but can get down to those kinds of depths. And other than that, it's the only game in town. Schmidt Ocean Institute has recently commissioned Woods Hole to build their own version of kind of a Nereus replacement for Schmidt, which is great, great timing. That vehicle will probably, Nereus cost about $8 million. The new Schmidt-type vehicle will probably be on the order of $15 to $20 million when all is said and done. It sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money, but as opposed to not getting to visit and explore those places and do the research, it's not that much money. It's less than the cost of a single Black Hawk helicopter.
And so important, too, because so little is known. Mm-hmm. Now, on this upcoming Loihi expedition, if all goes well, if you had a perfect run, what do you hope to accomplish or find?
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, it's certainly different, and the game has changed in the last 2 weeks with the loss of an ROV and moving everything into an AUV. Our objectives changed a little bit. We're a little bit more focused on the water column, thinking about an elemental budget of how much is the hydrothermal fluids coming out of Luigi altering and changing and interacting with the Pacific Ocean at large. So we have a very large shipboard hydrocast type where we're collecting water from the water column and bringing that on the ship. And then the emphasis for AUV Sentry will be mapping and exploration. And the golden ticket would be if we actually found a live eruption at 5,000 meters, which has never been observed. We've got a couple spots that we preliminary data from last year when we were there show that at least we should probably find some pretty exciting things that we only started to verify exist down there. In terms of this deep, deep hydrothermal fluids and microbial interactions.
Well, I'm excited to see what you're able to come up with. And so people really understand the amount of work and planning that goes into this. It's not like you wake up one day and say, I think I'm going to take a ship out to Lauihi. What kind of time frame and effort goes into something like this?
Oh, yeah, it's years. So I first learned of the Schmidt Ocean Institute over 2 years ago. And when they found the foundation and when they started refitting the ship, their science director, Victor Zygoff, did what I understand to be kind of a world tour, letting the research community know that there's a new game in town and get your pre-proposals ready. And so it went through a pretty rigorous proposal review process, similar to what we do for federal funding. A pre-proposal, a full proposal that's all peer-reviewed, and then is finally awarded. And so it's been, you know, several years in the making for sure, just to gain the ship time, and then to actually support the research as well as another whole game and round of proposals and funding and students and equipment and supplies. And it's a huge endeavor.
Well, we're very excited to go along with you on this journey. For those of us that want more and want to follow the expedition, where can we do that?
Sure. You know, Google is your friend, not just because it allowed Eric and Wendy Schmidt to have the Falkor and to send us to sea, but use Google and you can find links to the Schmidt Ocean Institute. You can Google me, Brian Glazer, and on my homepage there'll be a live link to updates that we're providing from the ship as well.
Well, we wish you the best of luck and hope you have an excellent expedition. I can't wait to hear about the discoveries. We're going to take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, we are going to hear about the mysteries and wonder of octopi.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Travel to the west side is extra slow because of the rain this afternoon. The H1 and the Wanalua both backed up to Middle Street. H1 lets up out at Sears. Traffic coming into town from the west is slow from Middle Street to Punahou. Conditions normal going east to Hawaii Kai and to the windward side. No new accidents. The last ones were in town at King and A'ala Park and in Iwale on Nimitz westbound by Hilo Hatties.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
Aloha. This is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. Do you want free 5 panels? How about a free trip to Vegas? I know, free financing. Then don't call me. For 25 years, Kamiyama Solar believes in treating our clients with respect. We do not subcontract. We do not offer anything for free, besides Aloha. What we do offer is hands-on installation with 25 years of experience and a 10-year workmanship warranty. Call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200. Aloha at 554-7200.
280,000 acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kaho'olawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha, I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms, and this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opilioahu.com.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis. You know, I'm offering you folks a chance to get an education. This time about on-bill financing. You've heard about the new bill the governor signed, paying for your photovoltaic system on your electricity bill. As you may know, the governor just signed this revolutionary bill, and it is directed and aimed at folks that have no ability to find the upfront money for their photovoltaic purchase. If you have questions, you can always call me or attend my seminar. Get a hold of me at 554-7200. That's 554-7200, and aloha.
So you're doing the right thing. You're getting a solar voltaic system for your home or business. But did you know the crucial decision is which microinverter to choose? A microinverter is what's going to convert the sunshine from your solar panels into electricity you can use.
But not all microinverters are created equal.
The Enexis microinverter system dramatically boosts energy harvest with higher wattage microinverters. We're talking up to 40% over its competitors. Year after year, you'll be getting more bang for your buck.
Because not all microinverters are created equal.
So make sure your contractor offers the Enexis microinverter with the system you can monitor yourself. Your system will shine today and be ready for a brilliant tomorrow. For more information, visit enexis.com. That's enexis.com. ENECSYS.com. That's ENECSYS.com.
My name is Braden DeVos, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, Solar Guy.
Welcome back. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and now we are switching from deep sea research and corals to octopi, which is the plural for, is it octopus or octopuses?
It's actually octopuses is the current nomenclature.
Okay, yeah. There we go. Welcome to the show, Heather.
Well, thank you for having me.
So Heather Ilato Ward is a PhD candidate from the University of Hawaii Zoology Department, and you are studying octopus.
Indeed I am.
All right. So first, tell us a little bit about why you chose to study this and what you're doing.
Well, I've always been really interested in cephalopods, and so that includes nautilus and squid and cuttlefish and octopuses. I just think they're really fascinating animals. They're, you know, these squishy invertebrates that are extremely smart. They can camouflage. They can solve puzzles. I mean, they're really pretty interesting animals. And so when I came to Hawaii for grad school, I knew I wanted to study octopuses. And, you know, I was also really interested in mating behavior and sexual selection. So sort of the things that enable these animals to mate and, you know, pass on their genes. So when I first was studying out here, I was actually looking at the day octopus, which is the one that everybody eats out here. It's delicious taco poke. But ultimately, because I wanted to do mating behavior, I wanted to look at a smaller octopus. And somebody introduced me to the rock taco. And so that's Octopus oliveri. And so that's the species that I'm currently studying because it's smaller. You can have lots of them in the lab at once, and you can do mating experiments with them.
So I'm dying to know, how do they mate?
Well, they... male has one arm that is called the hectocotylus, and it's usually the third arm on the right. And he will insert that arm into the female mantle. So basically, when you're looking at an octopus, you see that big kind of head area. That's the mantle. And so he reaches out his arm, and he puts it into the female, and he will pump sperm packets in there. And that's pretty much how an octopus mates. That's how most octopuses mate. There are a few exceptions. There, for example, the blanket octopus is very exciting because the female is about 2 meters long and the male is tiny. And so he's got a hectocotylus too. But in his case, it detaches from his body and swims up into the female. So he's only got one chance to mate. But for most octopuses, the males will mate several times with multiple females and with their one hectocotylus that they can keep for their whole life.
There are so many jokes and stories to go with there, but we're a family-friendly show, so I'm not even going to go there. But that is fascinating. I had no idea about that and wasn't expecting that answer at all. And that's amazing. So how does this all fit into what you do and your and how you're studying their mating behaviors?
Right. So I'm interested in looking at multiple paternity. And so what that means, like I was saying, the female will mate with actually several males before she lays her thousands of eggs. And she can also store sperm from multiple males in two separate places in her body, and she can store it for up to several months. And so I'm interested in finding out whether or not she's using the sperm from all of the males that she's mating with, or if one male is more successful in fertilizing the brood. And so in order to do that, I did some behavioral experiments. So I mated a female with three different males. And so I was looking at a large male, a kind of medium-sized male, and a small male. I'm interested in seeing whether the female is preferentially allowing one male to mate with her longer than another. And then after that, I allowed the female to lay her eggs, and then I did a genetic study with the brood. So once she's laid all of her eggs, now I can take the eggs and do genetic testing on them. It's basically like Jerry Springer for octopuses. Who's your daddy?
Sounds amazing. And how far along are you in the research? Have you begun to see any trends or patterns yet?
Oh, so that's a great question. So I finished all of the behavioral analysis, and some of the things that I ended up seeing there was that the females are mating with these multiple males, just like I thought, and there doesn't seem to be any pattern at all. Sometimes the first male is mating longer, sometimes the second, sometimes the third. Sometimes it's the big one, sometimes it's the little one. And so there, it's possible that there's some chemical cues that I can't see, but it looks like there's no real preference there. However, one of the interesting things I did see was sometimes the females would remove sperm packets after mating happened. And whether or not it's because she didn't like that particular male, or maybe he just didn't insert it correctly, and so it's kind of, she's rejecting it because it's not in the right place, I don't know that yet. But the genetics is going to be able to tell me the answer to that question. And so, right now, I've been doing the genetics work, and I do have some preliminary results that are showing that there's likely multiple paternity. So there are multiple males who are contributing to the brood. And that kind of makes sense, because if you think about evolutionarily, the more diversity you're going to have, the more likely your offspring are going to survive. So it makes sense that there would be multiple paternity in this particular species. But whether it's the last male or the first male or the large male or the small male, if there's a ratio, I haven't actually been able to see that yet. I've just recently done the genetics, so I see that there's multiple paternity, but whether there's a ratio, I haven't been able to figure it out yet.
It's such fascinating work. I mean, they are really unique and interesting species. And how, when you go through the genetics, I mean, genetics can sometimes be this ominous term. How do you do that? Are you taking samples from an individual octopus? And then what do you do with that sample once you have it?
Yeah, so basically I've got all of the females, so I know who the mom is. And then I've got samples from all of the males that she mated with in captivity. It's possible that she mated with males when she was out in the field, but we can try and figure that out after we do the genetic analysis. And then with the eggs, I'm getting samples of the babies. And then basically the idea is that you have, if you think about some sex, if you think about the sex chromosome, mm-hmm. So the X and the Y, that's kind of the easiest way to think about it. You know, the X comes from the mom and the Y comes from the dad. And so when you're having these babies, you're going to have one allele or one of an X from the mm-hmm. mom and a Y from the dad. And so I can go through and see, oh, this Y belongs to this male, this Y belongs to this male. And so I can look through and figure out genetically who is contributing to the offspring.
It's amazing. You get to map octopus sex all day.
Indeed, that's exactly it.
Well, I hope you're going to have a fun dissertation title with all of that.
Yeah, who's your daddy is one of the possibilities at this point.
That's awesome. I'd also like to contribute, size doesn't matter.
Oh, that's a good one, too.
So what are your next steps once you finish the research? What's next for you?
Well, part of doing this research has made me spend a lot of time looking at other cephalopod species, and I'm actually starting to look into how this is applicable into fisheries, because the more that we know about life history of an animal, the more you can contribute to management of fisheries. And there's a lot of places that fish octopus, and not this particular species, but like the day octopus in Hawaii, or and they also fish that in Madagascar and in Tanzania. And so I'm interested in sort of applying sexual selection and life history research into sustainable artisanal fisheries.
Excellent. And if you, in a short 30-second clip, could give some advice for those who want to learn more about the ocean, what advice would that be?
I suppose it would be to just keep learning, keep listening to shows like this, you know, get out there and get in the water and get inspired and just keep digging into what you love, because it's really rewarding.
Well, I cannot wait to hear more about your octopus sex research, and I want to thank you for taking some time to speak on the show today. Lots of interesting topics here and lots of wondrous ocean to explore. For those people that are interested, this Thursday evening, Chip Fletcher will be giving a lecture at St. Louis Heights on sea level in Hawaii, and that's hosted by the Waikiki Aquarium. And I want to thank the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, Centers for Ocean Science Education Excellence, and to Jeff Davis for letting me host the show today. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. Thanks for listening. Now get out there and enjoy your ocean planet.